All right, implementation issues. Who do I give the floor to? Javed? Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. So agenda paper 12A summarizes the committee's September meeting. The committee discussed 13 matters. It published 4 final agenda decisions and 6 tentative agenda decisions. It provided feedback on 2 matters being considered by the board and discussed 1 other matter. I will first talk briefly about the final agenda decision, which start on page 7. The first 2 agenda decisions explain how an entity applies the requirements of IAS 23 in capitalizing borrowing costs in particular situations. The third agenda decision, which is on IAS 21, it starts on page 8, and it discusses the determination of the exchange rate in particular extreme circumstances that exist in Venezuela. This was reported to you at a previous meeting, so I will not go into details at this stage unless you have specific questions. Also, as reported previously on this matter, the committee also decided to research possible narrow scope standard setting to address the exchange rate an entity uses when the spot rate is not observable. The committee will discuss this research at a future meeting. The last agenda decision on page 10 relates to a particular type of financial instrument. The committee decided not to add this matter to its agenda because the financial instrument described in the request was not common. And the committee also did not obtain any evidence that the matter had any widespread effect. So with that, I'll now move on to the tentative agenda decision. We'll start on page 2 of the IFRIC update. The first matter relates to the application of IFRS 15 and the recognition of revenue by a stock exchange that provides a listing service to a customer. Now, similar to the previous agenda decisions on IFRS 15, which were published earlier this year, this agenda decision first sets out more generally how an entity would apply the applicable requirements and then goes on to address the specific question that was asked. The second agenda decision, which starts on page 3, relates to the recognition of liabilities by a joint operator in a joint operation that is not structured through a separate legal vehicle. Now, in this fact pattern, one of the joint operators, as a sole signatory, enters into a lease arrangement with a third-party lessor for an item of property, plant, and equipment, which will be operated jointly as part of the joint operations activities. And the question was really whether the operator who signed the lease agreement should recognize the entire lease liability with the corresponding receivable from the other operators, or whether they just recognize their proportionate share of the lease liability. Now, both of these were practical application matters relating to the application of IFRS 15 in the case of the first one, and the second one came about more because of IFRS 16 and there being more leases on the balance sheet. So the committee responded quickly to address these matters. The next 2 agenda decisions, tentative agenda decisions, will start on page 4, relate to the accounting for changes of interest in a subsidiary in separate financial statements when the entity accounts for its investment in subsidiaries using the cost, applying cost. There's just one point in them that I want, in the second one that I want to highlight, and it relates to the step acquisition transaction. And as noted in the agenda decision, the committee concluded that there are 2 possible approaches that an entity could apply when determining the cost of any interest that it held previously before it acquired control of that subsidiary. And the committee members did express a preference for one of those approaches, and they did consider whether they should undertake standard setting to address this, but on balance, for reasons outlined in the tentative agenda decision, they have currently decided not to undertake standard setting, but we'll wait and see what the comments say on that. And the last tentative agenda decision I want to highlight is towards the bottom of page 6. It relates to the application of the highly probable requirement in a cash flow head relationship. Now, this is a matter on which the committee had previously published a tentative agenda decision. In that previous agenda decision, the committee observed that the financial instrument that was described in the request was not common. Now, when the committee considered the comment letters confirmed the committee's understanding that that particular instrument was not common. But the comment letters also highlighted a broader matter relating to the application of the applicable requirement. And the committee observed it could usefully respond to this broader matter and accordingly have published another tentative, a revised tentative agenda decision, which contains helpful explanatory information on this broader matter. Now, besides the final and tentative agenda decision, the committee also provided feedback and advice on cryptocurrencies and the board's proposed narrow scope amendments on IS 8 regarding accounting policies and accounting estimates. Feedback that we received from the committee will be shared with you at a future meeting. And lastly, the committee also discussed the accounting for particular cloud computing arrangements. It will continue discussion on this matter at a future meeting. So I will stop there and ask if you have any particular question on the matters contained in the CIFRIC update before we move on to the next topic. Right. So maybe with that, yes. I'll hand over to Gustavo.
Gustavo?
Yes.
No. Stay away from the mic. Well, now you have to push it back in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. We're now moving to agenda paper 12B. At its meetings in March and June 2018, the IFRS Interpretations Committee discussed the question about the recognition of deferred taxes when a lessee recognizes an asset and liability at lease commencement. The same question arises in relation to the recognition of decommissioning assets and liabilities. After these discussions, the committee decided to recommend that the board proposes a narrow scope amendment to IS 12. The staff analysis of this matter and the committee's recommendation are included in agenda paper 12B. Given the complexity of the topic, we thought it would be helpful to also provide a brief educational session on the matter. The slides we will use for this session were included as agenda paper 12C. We will now start by recapping some of the key concepts in IS 12. IS 12 requires entities to recognize deferred taxes for all temporary differences, with a few exceptions. Temporary differences, in turn, are calculated by comparing the carrying amounts of assets and liabilities with their tax bases. Finally, the tax base of an asset and liability is the amount attributable to them for tax purposes. One of the exceptions to the general recognition principle is the initial recognition exemption. This exemption prohibits entities from recognizing deferred taxes on the initial recognition of an asset or liability in a transaction that is not a business combination and affects neither accounting profit nor taxable profit. We will now describe the question received by the committee. The submission described a fact pattern in which a lessee recognizes an asset and a liability at the commencement date of the lease. A similar question arises when accounting for decommissioning obligations. As in the paper, we will present our analysis using leases as an example, but note that it applies equally to decommissioning assets and liabilities. In this example, an entity recognizes a lease asset and a lease liability at the present value of these payments of 135 on lease commencement. The fact pattern also states that the entity receives tax deductions when lease payments are made. Applying the requirements of IAS 12, an entity determines the tax base of the lease asset and lease liability in order to assess whether temporary differences arise on initial recognition. As the entity receives a single set of tax deductions when these payments are made, we think an entity should consider the applicable tax law to determine whether the tax deductions are attributable to the use of the lease asset, i.e. depreciation, or to the repayment of the lease liability. This determination is important because it affects whether or not temporary differences arise on initial recognition. To illustrate this, let's first consider a scenario in which the tax deductions relate to the lease asset. When determining whether temporary differences arise, the entity would compare the carrying amounts of the lease asset and lease liability, both equal to 435, with their tax bases. By referring to the definition of tax base of an asset in IS 12, shown in this slide, the entity would in this scenario determine that the tax base of the lease asset equals its carrying amount. This is because the entity determines that it receives deductions for the use of the lease asset. Similarly, the tax base of the lease liability would equal its carrying amount. This is because the entity would not receive any tax deductions for repaying the principal of the lease liability. it follows that no temporary differences arise on initial recognition. Now let's look into the other scenario where an entity attributes tax deductions to the repayment of the lease liability. Apply the same process as we just described, the entity would compare the tax base of the lease asset and lease liability with their carrying amounts of 135. This time, applying the definitions of tax base of assets and liabilities in IAS 12, the entity would conclude that the tax base of the asset is nil because the entity does not receive tax deductions from using the asset. The entity would also conclude that the tax base of the liability is nil because the principal of the lease liability will be fully deductible for tax purposes. It follows that temporary differences arise in relation to both the asset and the liability. These temporary differences are equal and offset each other. However, that does not mean that the two scenarios give the same accounting outcome over the life of the lease. There are important differences after initial recognition that we will come onto. Having identified these temporary differences, the question that follows is whether and how the initial recognition exemption would apply to them. In the previous two slides, we have established that temporary differences may arise depending on how entities allocate the tax deductions they receive from the lease. In particular, this is the case when entities determine the tax deductions are attributable to the lease liability. This slide reproduces the wording of the initial recognition exemption in paragraph 15 and 24 of IAS 12. We think that the exemption in these paragraphs applies separately to each temporary difference arising on the initial recognition. It follows that when temporary differences arise, an entity does not recognize deferred taxes, either on initial recognition or subsequently. The effects of not recognizing deferred taxes are illustrated in the following slide. The first graph illustrates the outcome of recognizing deferred taxes over the term of the lease. It shows that the tax expense recognized over time is proportional to profit before tax, resulting in a constant effective tax rate over the period. This reflects the tax effects in profit and loss in line with the recovery of the asset and the accrual of interest over the lease liability. The second graph illustrates the outcome of not recognizing deferred taxes. It shows that the tax expense is constant over time, resulting in a different effective tax rate at each period. This reflects the tax effects of the transaction in profit or loss as the tax deductions become available for tax purposes. This graph shows that there are significant effects of applying or not applying the initial recognition exemption, despite the fact that the net temporary difference on initial recognition is zero. Because of this, the committee assessed what is the purpose of the initial recognition exemption and whether it was necessary in the fact pattern under analysis. Paragraph 22C of IS 12, shown in this slide, explains the purpose of the initial recognition exemption. It states that without the exemption, an entity would recognize deferred taxes and adjust the carrying amounts of the related asset or liability by the same amount. It also states that such adjustments would make the financial statements less transparent. To illustrate, consider the unrelated example of a purchase of a non-deductible PP&E for cash of 100. Recognition of such assets would give rise to taxable temporary differences of 100. Assuming that the initial recognition exemption did not exist, an entity would recognize a deferred tax liability of 20, also assuming a tax rate of 20%. In doing so, the entity would have to recognize the debit entry as either an adjustment to the carrying amount of the PP&E item or as an expense in profit or loss. The initial recognition exemption exists precisely to avoid such outcomes. Let's now look into whether the initial recognition exemption is necessary in the specific fact pattern the committee considered. This slide shows the scenario where temporary differences arise on initial recognition. If the initial recognition exemption were not applied, an entity would book the following journal entries. In this case, the recognition of deferred taxes would have no effect in profit or loss, nor it would require an entity to adjust the carrying amounts of the lease asset or liability. Furthermore, the deferred tax assets and liabilities would generally be offset on balance sheets for presentation purposes. The committee noted this outcome and decided to recommend that the board proposes an amendment to IS-12. The amendment recommended by the committee is to narrow the applicability of the initial recognition exemption so that it would not apply to transactions that give rise to both taxable and deductible temporary differences, to the extent that the amounts recognized for the temporary differences are the same. Therefore, by not applying the exemption, entities would apply the general requirement in IS-12 to recognize deferred taxes. The committee also noted that the amendment would result in entities recognizing deferred tax assets and liabilities of the same amount, and only to the extent an entity is able to recognize deferred taxes in accordance with IS-12. I would now like to direct your attention to the question in page 26 of Agenda Paper 12B and ask you whether you agree with the committee's recommendation. Thank you.
Well, this was a quite remarkable presentation, I must say. And I think thanks to this innovative use of slides, this otherwise very complicated affair has become crystal clear to me. Thank you very much. I understand why people are laughing now. Okay. Who wants to raise a question? Yes, Nick.
Thank you. Yeah, I spend a lot of time doing my homework. It's a bit messy, though, unfortunately. But I do think I got to the nub of the issue. And what really helped me, I didn't appreciate to begin with that the exemption was mandatory rather than optional. Once I realised it was mandatory, that helped me. And I think what's being proposed is an elegant solution. My reservation and why I'm not completely sure is whether this will actually make any difference to any investment decision. By doing this, I can see that there is, I can see the elegance, I can see this takes out an anomaly, takes out some diversity. There's clearly some cost in implementing it, but I wonder whether it just gets lost.
Is it worth it?
In the noise is my reservation at the moment.
I agree that we should proceed with the proposal following the recommendation of the committee. I agree with Nick that there may well be circumstances when it doesn't have a material effect, but I think the committee found that there was diversity in application, and I think people have found perhaps ways to deal with it in the past in different situations, but I think by sort of crossing their fingers, standing on one leg and hoping. And so I think would be good to tidy it up, and I think it'll be important through the exposure process to make sure we understand that, you know, it actually is worth doing. But if you think deferred tax matters, I guess, then we'd want it to work properly in this situation like we do in all others. So I think we should proceed with it.
I saw a bit of a cynical view in
no.
Martin's eyes.
That's not right. No, I agree with the analysis of the paper. I'm also maybe like Nick a little bit concerned, man. If people have used this kind of exemption and they have not calculated deferred taxes, but I think the problem is now with all these operating leases coming on balance sheet, and they have to do that if we're doing these amendments. And is it really material? Because in most of the situations, I think it is quite, because we have now this interest payment on different, we have not a straight line expense, which maybe was in the past, and therefore, okay, they have some deferred taxes, but is it really material? And the question is, what does really the cost for a company if they have thousands of these smaller lease items, they have to calculate deferred taxes on that? And that is, I'm a little bit concerned, and question is to the staff, can we do, I know materiality would apply also to that, but materiality is also, I think auditors will ask, okay, please demonstrate it is not material, so you have to do all the calculations. Do we have any idea how we make it more easier not to doing that if it is really, I think, not material? I don't have a good idea now, but I think that is only my concern, because I totally agree with the analysis, that is perfect, but I'm concerned about the implications then that people with a new leasing standard have to do a lot of work to coming up with deferred tax numbers, which maybe are not material.
Peter?
I think there's another dimension to the cost question, which is that at the moment people have to separate the assets and liabilities into ones that are covered by the exemption and ones that aren't. So by taking away a piece of that when it's not really needed and not intended. It might actually reduce some costs.
Doc.
Thank you. I agree with staff's recommendation. Actually, in many jurisdictions for finance leases, they make tax rules in accordance with accounting rules. So therefore, currently, it is not really the issue. Yes. However, IFRS 16 was introduced, and one of the problem is inconsistency within IFRS 16. That is, our lessee can enjoy the top-heavy expenses, whereas lessor has a straight line. So if you look at this from the viewpoint of government, so the lessee will enjoy the tax deduction first, but the lessor will not recognize profit in the first place. So it, in the outset, then the tax revenue will decrease. So therefore, it is not likely that the tax rules will be in harmonized with the accounting standards. So therefore, this issue would be very prevailing in all over the world once IFRS 16 is implemented. So therefore, we definitely need to address. The question is whether or not it's significant enough to change the standard. However, I think currently it is not very significant, but there is a potential that it could be significant because of the interest rate change or the significance of operating lease. We don't know how much the operating lease is all about. So if we had a research project of IS 12, then we can address it in that process. However, we decided not to pursue the research project of IS 12. So there is no way other than having this amendment. So I agree with that.
Amaru.
Thanks. I would like to first start commending the staff for the paper and for the presentation. It really made much simpler to understand. Thanks very much, Gustavo. I think it was really excellent and acknowledged by Hans was important to me at inception.
Being genuine.
Just one question on this. Well, IFRS 16 is coming into effect in 1st of January. So what do we have in mind in terms of if we go ahead with the agreeing with staff and the proposal, this is going for a narrow scope amendment. So in terms of timing, what do we envisage? I know it's fairly early maybe, but what do you envisage? Because I guess when this becomes effective, IFRS 16 will be already into effect. And people would be, well, since it was raised by Nick, this is a requirement, the exemption. They will apply the exemption, and then they will have to come back and recognize. So this was something that I wasn't very clear.
We know IFRS 16 is coming out. We thought that we would be able to make this amendment and have, you know, a normal lead time, but allow early application if people wanted to enable them to take advantage of it to match up with IFRS 16 coming in. Mm-hmm. We were also comparing it that IFRIC had thought as an alternative to give some interpretation guidance on, you know, how you decide what the tax base of the asset or liability is. And we did think that an advantage of this, of having it as an amendment, would mean that we weren't sort of casting doubt on what people had done before or whether that was right or wrong. We were making it clear that you know, this is what we think is right going forward, but it is a change from previous requirements.
Gary?
Thank you. Like the others, I agree with the staff recommendations. In fact, I strongly agree with the staff recommendations. I think any time you have the word exemption or exclusion, it's always problematic at some point in time or another. And I don't remember if this number is just our number or the converged number, but I think we're talking like $2 trillion of these things going on the global balance sheets, of which I get them if that's with or without FASB. That would tell me you're talking several hundred billion dollars of deferred taxes. Yeah. And when I look at paragraph 24, agenda paper is I'm inclined, if you don't have book tax conformity rules on this sense, I mean, the tax authorities are not getting it into, well, is your payment for the asset or is it for the liability? They just don't care. It's not relevant to them. And having dealt with a few of them on and off over the years and both prior lives, is they don't like to get into these debates. The answer is the law is the law. This is all I can speak on with authority. I'm not going to help you with your auditors or lawyers or your tax case. So I don't think in the main you can look to the tax authorities to help you out. And if it's judgment, whether I deem the deduction as the depreciation or if I deem it as the payment of the obligation, to some extent, you don't really care. You process the check for the amount due and you get your tax return as it's supposed to. But if it's judgment, I mean, absent something extraneously large by itself, I would say you'd go to what the path of least work resistance internally is what you would do. No, no one would deliberately want to just put deferred tax assets on the books. I mean, because then you got to test them for impairment and everything else. So to me, the judgment's either I think if I read it right, calling it a payment of lease liability is less internal work than if I call it a deduction for the depreciation. And I think since we say it's judgment, there will be diversity in practice. Numbers are way too big for there not to be. So I think we've got the right answer here, and I strongly support it.
Mary.
I support doing what the staff has proposed, but I actually wanted to ask you to think about going one step further. If you look back on slide 8, and don't worry about pulling it up again, the slide 8, you know, you go through, is the exemption necessary for leases? And you know, one of the assumptions you have here is debit deferred tax asset of 87. Now, there are limits that apply to recognition of deferred tax assets that do not apply to limits to recognition of deferred tax liabilities. And I think, you know, and the staff has analyzed in Appendix B this issue and said, not sure that it, you know, it's an existing issue through IS-12. We don't want scope creep and try and answer, you know, one of the longstanding practice issues that's pervasive when we can't, you know, when we're trying to do a focused response. I think we should try and answer that issue in the context of the type of situations we're talking about here by taking the amendment a little further, because I think that there may be more scenarios than the staff anticipates in Appendix B, although maybe not as many as I had feared initially. I think there may be more scenarios, particularly associated with the decommissioning liabilities, that you have asymmetry in terms of, you know, here are the numbers 87 of tax asset and 87 of tax liability, or maybe you'd have 40 of tax asset and 87 of tax liability. Then, as Appendix B lays out, the initial recognition exemption will apply to the remainder of the tax liability, but not to the revision of your recoverability estimate on the asset side. So my suggestion for addressing this is to expand the proposed amendment to say that the initial recognition exemption also would apply to any deferred tax asset not recognized initially because of recoverability concerns. So you get symmetry going forward. I think it isn't trying to resolve the bigger issue of whether you're assessing which step you take first, et cetera. It's just in the context of this amendment, resolving that. And I don't want to find out as a consequence of exposing a narrow scope amendment that the issue addressed in Appendix B is bigger than we thought and that we have to do something more to address it. I think that would just leave us further in the hole with respect to the timing issue.
I think what you're asking for is the deferred tax asset pre-evaluation allowance if we in fact had it in our standards.
Right, but we can't do that because the way we're wording the exemption, mm-hmm. the proposed amendment to the exemption, it says to the extent recognized, and I actually talked with Gustavo before, before the session, we couldn't think of a way to tweak the wording on the exemption so that you made the assessment of the initial recognition exemption come first. So I think we have to try and fix it this way.
I agree with you. Again, if we have the relation allowance concept, it would be recognized and reserved.
Yeah.
In here, in the case, you'd say I recognized and immediately wrote it off.
Yeah.
You know, so it is the before the impairment adjustments, if you will.
But because we don't have that.
No, we need to clarify that.
Yeah.
Doc?
Just a quick question about disclosure. So if we accept this proposal, so disclosure would be gross basis, asset and liability, both. Is my understanding correct?
So on that, you would just apply the normal disclosure requirements in IAS 12, and then there are specific rules on offsetting deferred tax assets and liabilities as well, and you would just assess whether they meet the criteria for offsetting.
Offsetting.
I think in our paper we say that we think in several cases they will meet the criteria for offsetting.
All right.
So on a net basis on your presentation, you will probably show them on a net basis if you meet the criteria, but you may need to track some of these amounts separately for the disclosure requirement.
Okay,
can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
14.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well done.
We can explore your idea for the moment.
If it blows up this whole thing, it's not worth it, but I think it.
I think it's going to come back if we don't deal with it.
Okay, so that's it for implementation issues. Thank you.